The Friedberg Niagara, I should say, conference call. I'm David Rothberg, the founder of Niagara, and it's my pleasure to have on the line with us Al Friedberg, the portfolio manager of the Friedberg Global Macro Hedge Fund and the Friedberg Asset Allocation Fund. Good morning, Al. How are you doing this morning?
Good morning. Fine.
Good. Just before we start, a little bit of housekeeping. My colleague Edwin Rott tells me that I always have to state the date. Today is Wednesday, the 24th of July. I'm talking on Skype.
I think it's Thursday.
Excuse me, it's Thursday, the 24th of July. The reason I'm a little bit off is that I'm on vacation. I'm in a remote part of Cape Breton, Nova Scotia, and I'm actually talking on Skype because, being as remote as I am, it's a little bit difficult to get cell phone coverage from time to time. So I'm hoping this works out. Our conference call is going to last. We try and keep it to 45 minutes, and I have a list of questions from investors and prospective investors. If you have questions that you'd like to have asked, please email them to me at drothberg@niagaracapital.ca. Okay, without any further ado, Al, let's get to it. I think, though you quite eloquently stated it in your second quarter report, it might be good just to have an overview of how you see the world and how you position the funds accordingly. Would you mind starting there?
Sure. Okay. The picture, I think, has become a lot clearer in the last few months. The U.S. is on a good course, on a good course in terms of growth. Employment is growing, and we are actually getting to unemployment levels that are much better than originally estimated. Chances are that we're going to be dipping into the fives. We're going to have a five handle on the unemployment area, and in the meantime, there's been no pressure on margins, which is interesting. There's been no pressure yet, and no substantial pressure on wages. So profit margins remain good, remain better than expected. So in the U.S., the picture is quite bright from an economic growth point of view. I'm not speaking about problems that are being stored up in the future because of the monetary policy that we're following, but for now, the next 6 months look pretty clear. Europe remains kind of weakish, very little growth, and very, very little progress on unemployment. And China, we found out last night, China is back on a higher rate of growth. Again, artificial, stimulated, probably too much stimulation going on there, but that is lifting probably world growth too. And so generally speaking, the global economy, let's put it this way, the global economy led by the U.S. And then China second, and Britain maybe third, are moving ahead, moving forward, and there's still some very interesting profitability numbers coming out of the U.S., so that should maintain stock prices at a high level for now. So that's pretty clear. We are beginning to see a little bit of higher inflation than expected also at the same time in the U.S., and that will create problems later on, but for now I think that it should be pretty well contained within what the Fed wants to see.
Sorry, go ahead.
No, the Fed has come out saying that they not only will be coming out of QE in October, but that the rates will begin to go up sometime. I mean, they expect rates to go up sometime next year. The market is still reflecting lower Fed funds rates than what the Fed has expected. So, in other words, the market is saying that the Fed is being a little bit too hawkish in its outlook. we have taken the opportunity to actually trade and put on some Fed funds interest rate hedges because we find them that they're cheap. But generally, then the picture is one. As I said before, it's clear in the near term. It's clear. And I think that there is now the possibility, and we'll come to that, we'll discuss that when it comes, for instance, to housing in the U.S. There is the cycle has been extended, but it is moving, and the upswing is in the making when it comes to housing, and that should be a strong pillar for the economy going forward.
So I'll put then to you a leading question. You are now net long. Your equity position in the fund is now net long to the tune of about 58% of the assets of the fund. And your short exposure in the U.S. is pretty well restricted, except for the short side of the equity hedge program, is pretty well restricted to puts on the S&P. Are we to assume then that your view is that stock prices will grind higher in general, and we'll get to that specific sectors later, but in general that stock prices will grind higher, but that the risk is of a correction that will be sharp but short?
Yeah, precisely. I think that's what we are thinking. We're thinking that the market is shown to be pretty resilient to political news, military news, political military news, and we have had very, very low volume on declines. We have had low volumes on the upside too, but there doesn't seem to be much technical damage to this market. We look at things like, for instance, the amount of new lows of individual stocks or groups, and we see almost nothing. So generally speaking, the technical underpinnings of the markets are good. It reacts well to bad news. So we think that the path of least resistance is upward. Having said that, it is possible for the market to be hit by surprising news and like a major default somewhere. And we saw what happened last week with Espírito do Santo in Portugal, where a bank looked like it was going to default, and there was a sharp correction in the market for one day. So these things can happen, and if they do, we will see the market come down rather quickly. But we don't think that that's a bear market. It may go down very quickly and very far, but it's not a bear market. It's more like the type, and I'm not saying that that will happen, and I'm not saying that magnitude or that extent of what happened in 1987. It was a very sharp drop, but within a generally rising bull market. So, and the reason I say that is because there's still too many sectors and too many sectors in the market that have not been totally priced, have not been priced properly. So, as a protection to that sharp swing, and we are net long 58%. And by the way, the average, I saw an interesting report recently that the hedge fund net leverage in the U.S., and I'm talking mostly about long short funds. I think that's neutral funds and long market neutral funds and long short ones, is about 75% exposure. So ours is a little bit under that, but ours is very concentrated. Probably more concentrated than the other hedge funds. So even though our exposure is 58% long, but in a sharp decline, chances are good that volatility will expand, and that will reduce significantly our long exposure. So we're not too concerned about a sharp drop. And yes, we think that the path of least resistance is higher.
So let's turn then to where the opportunities lie. You've become very focused. You have two major themes. Could we speak about those, please?
Yeah. Well, housing remains the number one play for us. It's a sector that has not had yet its full It hasn't had yet. Let's put it this way. The cycle, the U.S. housing cycle is much longer than it has been in the past, and there's many reasons for that. And of course, the household formations are coming today at a later age. We had a tremendous amount of oversupply from foreclosures of the 2008-2009 disaster, and that took a long time to absorb. And so there was supply in the market for a long time at very low prices. So all these things were a factor in extending the cycle. The cycle is longer. Yet the cycle is still in the making. The upswing is still in the making. This sector, especially the housing sector, is trading at very reasonable multiples. Actually, their forward P ratios, the average forward P ratios on these is under 14.5 or under 14.75, which is below the market forward P ratios. And this does not take into account the fact that housing is one of those sectors that still has not had its full maturity. So we think that there is quite a bit of upside there. And I mentioned also in the letter that we have a position in Blackstone, which is a large position in Blackstone, which is a private equity firm that gains a great deal in this type of environment, this cheap money environment. They've done very well. So that's our exposure in equities for the most part. The other concentration that we have is commodities. In this case, it's primarily metals and oil, and that's based on the fact that we think that the upswing, the global economic upswing, is in place, and we're seeing also supply shortages in some of these markets. Some of it is regulatory, some of it is political. And we think that that is restricting the supply, and therefore small increases in demand will do well for prices. Those are our two main positions.
I'm going to act as the devil's advocate to both of them. The argument in housing originated with the idea that the Fed's provision of money would generate inflation. That failed to be much of a catalyst. Then the argument switched to increasing employment and having more money in consumers' pockets, and that hasn't proven to be a catalyst. Now the argument is delayed household formation, and I think that the obvious question, and I'm thinking of my own children who are who fit right into the demographic perfectly. Why would you be a buyer of a home? Why would you take on a mortgage when the future for interest rates seems much more likely to be higher than it is, and that your costs are going to increase rather than decrease? Where will the catalyst come? Where will the catalyst come from? And I think at the same time that I put this question to you, Al, how do we explain the consensus amongst home builders themselves is positive, and that owners of raw land are reporting a lot of activity on the sales side from prospective home builders who want the land to put up new product? There's a whole inconsistency with the lack of catalyst, is my point.
I don't think there is a lack of catalyst. You know, house prices have been going up now for 3 years, and going up creates its own demand. This we have seen in every market. Markets that go up after a while become a bit of a speculative vehicle. And even last month, we still had an increase of about 4 or 5% over last year. And prices have gone up more than 40% in the past 3 years. And I think that this is the catalyst. This is the main catalyst. I don't think that the mortgage rates of 4.5% or 5% will stand in the way of somebody buying a house, we think that the house will increase in value by substantially more than that. So the catalyst is rising prices. The catalyst is actually inflation, housing inflation. And in that, the Fed has been very successful. Whether it will continue, it probably will continue if credit availability is made, if we have better credit availability. And one of the problems has been in the past few years that banks have been bogged down by regulation and by what they can lend and how much they can lend to who they can lend. And there's been now an easing of those restrictions. We're getting much better availability of credit, and I think we'll be able to see that in the next few months. Till now, mortgage-induced purchases were a very small part of the new sales market, very small part. I think it was in the 20s. 20s, small proportion of sales were accounted for by mortgage buyers. A lot of the buying was done for cash. And, of course, we had institutional buyers that also did it for cash. But going forward, I think you're going to start seeing much more mortgage finance buying of homes.
Okay, I said I would be the devil's advocate to two questions, to both the long positions that you have regarding commodities. Both Deutsche Bank and Goldman Sachs have issued reports within the last 30 days, I think. That elucidate views they've held for quite some time and published for quite some time, saying that the commodity supercycle, the supercycle that existed during the period of China's growth, has come to an end, and what's forthcoming is likely to be a kind of supercycle in reverse. And largely this is because of China not growing at the same pace that it was, and by the natural response of commodity markets to inflated prices that existed at the head of the supercycle. You're flying in the face of the views of both these behemoths. What's your response to those, to their views?
Well, as I say, we have already seen strength in base metals, and the strength is. Countering those views, we are seeing prices of zinc and lead and copper improving to multi-month highs. Aluminum. I think that the main problem that we have is on the supply side today, which is projects are extremely costly, and there's a lot of political interference in projects. They take a long time to come to fruition. They cost an enormous amount of money. If you look at the projections for projects from beginning to end, often they more than double in cost.
You're talking about non-renewable commodities.
I'm talking about mostly non-renewable. You have write-offs, American Barrick, Newcrest, they've been writing off enormous amounts of projects because it's just too costly. So the supply side is a big problem in the non-renewables. And in the renewables, of course, a lot of it has to do with weather. We've had great weather, great planting conditions, so the grains have come down a great deal. Already, they've gone down a great deal already, but those things fluctuate with the weather. So weather problems like El Nino, for example, can rekindle the bull market in something like sugar. Other markets, like, for instance, cocoa, have made now, again, multi-year highs just even this morning. So it is a bit of a mixed picture. Some areas are going to be suffering from oversupply. For instance, iron ore. There's just too many projects, too many iron ore projects, and the iron ore is under pressure. I would agree with them that you're not going to see the same type of broad-based increase in commodity prices that you had in the 70s. I think that's a given. I think that you're not going to get that. but you will get a select group of commodities that have supply problems, and given demand increases, will show interesting increases in prices.
Thanks. Let's turn to gold, a commodity and also a form of money. You're exposed to gold. Again, it flies in the face of a kind of a gathering consensus that gold will lose competitive ground to equities. No dividend, you have to pay to store it. And with a rising equity market, which you concede is likely to occur, gold will not hold pace. What is your take on gold?
The demand for gold is made up of two elements in the demand picture. One of them is consumer demand, and that consumer demand comes from China and India primarily, and it's quite large. And we've seen this in India, for example, where there were some import restrictions for a few months, and to try to help their balance of trade. And as soon as those restrictions were lifted or partly restricted, you see the balance of trade going negative because there's a very large increase in gold consumption. Both of those countries, as their middle class grows, will have more and more buying of gold. So, and they do it for jewelry. So the consumer side of it is strong, very strong. And the side that has not yet reached its full potential, which will come, is and we'll see that when we get more doubts and more suspicion and more actual defaults of sovereign countries, we'll see that gold will start taking a much more important part of international reserves. We've seen that for the last 4 years, Europe has gone into a diet, what they call austerity, and yet the debt ratios of all of those countries, Italy, Spain, Portugal, Greece, have all risen. The debt ratios to GNP have risen. So the quality of their debt has gone down a great deal, including the U.S. The quality of the U.S. debt, so that at some point, a prudent central bank will want to own an asset that has much less credit risk. And there's no question in my mind that they will return. I'm not saying that 100% of reserves will be in gold like it used to be in the 19th century, but a good proportion of the international reserves will be constituted by gold. So the next step and I can't tell when it will happen, but the next step is an increase in the demand for gold from central banks as a form of diversification.
To what extent do you think anxiety about the U.S.'s ability to confiscate assets denominated in dollars plays a factor? And I'm thinking about not just China, but also Russia and wherever there's a dictatorial regimes.
Well, you know, Russia has increased reserves of gold, as an example, and you do have countries doing that because they're afraid, exactly what you're saying, they're afraid of the U.S. Confiscating their assets or freezing them. So there is some role for that. But I would think that the more important role to come is the monetary role, and that's putting gold back to where it used to be, maybe 100 years ago, or at least partly there, not fully there, but partly there.
Okay, thank you. You know, you're short Fed fund futures and Eurodollar futures, and it's as we were saying the other day when you and I were talking, your argument for a long time has been that the Fed would be late in cutting off money supply, that inflation would rise faster than they were able to control it. And yet, curiously, what's happened has been, as you acknowledge, that the market is actually now lagging the Fed. It's the Fed that's more hawkish than the market believes it will be. And you And you are taking in effect the Fed side. You're no longer fighting the Fed. You're actually trading alongside the Fed by being short interest rates. Can you elaborate a little bit on this?
Right. What I'm doing is I'm taking advantage of the fact that the market believes, like I do, that the Fed will move slower than what they're saying they will move. And so the market is pricing. As an example, the market is pricing today, December 15, Fed funds at, at 1, now at 105 or 1 or something like that, 1.05 for December 15th, which is right now the Fed funds rate is 25 points. So they're expecting the market, they expect the Fed to move rates up to 105. The Fed in its projection had projected 113 for that date. When we put on the position, we were able to do it at a rate of about 75 basis points. So it was considerably lower than what the Fed had projected. And we're saying we are going to hedge our views bet on the fact that the Fed will move faster than we think. So if they don't move faster than we think, then we have an extended cycle in stocks and commodities. If they move faster than we think, then we'll have a hedge on, which is via the Fed funds and euro dollars.
Can we overshoot? If we're at 105 now, can we overshoot 113?
Yeah, depends on numbers. It's very data dependent. So, for example, if we get a very quick drop in unemployment rate in the next 2 months, the market could overshoot. And the Fed may find itself actually behind the eight ball. Let's remember, the Fed hasn't done anything. All they've done is spoken about different scenarios. So we don't know where they stand. If very good unemployment numbers come out in the next couple of months, we don't know where they stand. They may or they may not react. She doesn't seem to be in a very big rush to react, Yellen. I think that she wants to get unemployment rate down very, very low before she moves, but we can't tell.
The other short that you have is still India. India's really been a nemesis for you this year, and your exposure is reduced a lot. But it's not in India in a broad-based way. It's specific sectors. Could you elaborate a little bit on where you stand with India?
No, India has been a nemesis, and we did reduce the position substantially. We are now in areas where we don't think – well, let me start by saying that Modi, at least for us, was a major disappointment. He had an opportunity to do something.
I'm talking about the prime minister,
yeah, the new prime minister. He had an opportunity to do something dramatic, to make dramatic changes to what's going on in India. He didn't. There was very little in that budget. Nothing actually in that budget that showed that he was interested in a global type of reform. He did introduce a few tweaks. He allowed, for instance, banks to issue debt to fund the infrastructure deals. Well, that helps some sectors, like certain banks. It will help banks. So it was very sort of targeted to certain sectors of the economy, We want to stay out of those sectors. Obviously, those sectors will benefit, but we don't think the country as a whole will do well. They're still mired in the stagflation. The inflation rates have come down a little bit, but they're still in the 8% range. Monetary policy cannot move very much from where it is today because of that inflation rate. We haven't yet seen what happens with the monsoon this year. It looks like it is 35% lower so far. The amount of rain coming into the country is about 35% lower than it was than the average, and that can cause food prices to skyrocket in the next few months. The last time it happened in 2009, food prices went up 16%. So the monetary policy is constrained. The rupee did have an improvement a few months ago when it was expected to Modi to come in, and after the new central banker came in. But since then, it has stabilized around the 60. So, again, I don't think there is much to speak about in terms of global improvement in India. I think that you are getting some improvement in some sectors, especially those that are helped directly by the government. And now we'll see whether it can manage out of this. There's been a tremendous inflow of foreign money into India. The big buyers have been the foreigners.
I see. Okay. So still short India, modestly by comparison to recent history, and very focused in your short position. Let's turn to a more sensitive subject. What's happened to global macro generally has been nothing short of tragic if you're an investor or a portfolio manager of a global macro strategy. Not just you, but some of the largest and most successful players have really had to bite the bullet in the past year. Assets have shrunk. People are running away. You've gone through the longest drawdown in your history. How are you feeling about the environment for global macro in general, and how has it affected your state of mind? How are you coping with this? How are you trying to recover yourself in this environment? And these are general questions, and I'm trying to describe an atmosphere that I'd like you to delve into, if you could.
Well, there's no question that the environment is a difficult one for global macro players, especially because there's been a tremendous drop in market volatility in almost every market, and going nowhere, especially for global macro players that tend to buy volatility and therefore lose money on carrying these things. Has been a nightmare in the past couple of years, but the same is true with, for example, commodity funds. They've suffered similarly from this type of choppy trading.
Managed futures.
Futures trading, choppy trading. So it's a difficult environment. That's why when I started my talk this morning, I said that the picture seems to have become a little clearer. I think that even though volatility remains very low, I think that the picture is becoming a little clearer in that we have a better handle now on the fact that there is directionality now. At least we can see directionality. We can see that, and we can probably bet on that. And my attitude has been to stay in those areas that we think have very strong merit, and be patient, and just try. We've cut down a great deal on leverage. It's not a moment to be extremely highly leveraged, but at the same time, we have maintained the main ideas and the main themes. And maintaining them rather than going in and out of them, I think, is sort of comforting because if you feel good about them, if you still feel good about them, that's comforting. I think that it would be very difficult to put on trades, construct trades, close them out, and construct a different trade, close it out. To do that a number of times, it's much too hard, and I see that some of our colleagues have left the business, have actually closed down their funds, and I think that's been very hard on them. This experience has been very hard on us too, but the fact is that we still ask ourselves every day, are these positions, do they have merit, are they good, and we think it's just a matter of patience. And that gives us the strength to remain so and to go forward.
If global macro is volatility dependent, then it's a two-part process. The first one is to make a call on whether or not there's going to be volatility, and then the second part is to place your bets in that environment. Is your first call or how do you make that call? What is your take on the future of volatility?
No, I'm not making a call on volatility. I think that has affected us, has affected everybody, but I think that more importantly is a call on the direction and on and some clear, for us at least, clear. I mean, every mutual fund in America that was long only, it was very clear for them that the market was going up. But for us, global macro players, seeing all these different kinds of problems around the world and being blinded almost by them, it wasn't so clear. So more important then is really getting a sense that the direction that you wanted to that you're looking for is there, is in the making, and so it's not a call on volatility, but I do think that at some point volatility will explode because it has cycles and it will explode, and then you got to be on the right side of it. So I think for example, our purchases today of put options in the S&P, the long-term put options in the S&P, they're very cheap from a volatility point of view, from an implied volatility point of view. It makes a lot of sense to buy them if you want to protect the portfolio. If you all you're doing is just trying to bet on increased volatility, I think that doesn't make sense because people have lost a lot of money trying to bet on the timing. But as a way of protecting portfolios, I think it makes a lot of sense.
Okay, Al, thanks very much. I think that we've reached our time limit. I'm out of questions. I've responded in general to, or I've put to you in general the sum of the questions that have been put to us. I'll take the opportunity to remind listeners that a podcast of our conversation will be posted and notice will be sent to you sometime this morning. And finally, to thank Albert for his time this morning and to wish you as a colleague and as an investor in your fund, all the best for the coming quarter.
Okay. Thank you, David. Bye-bye.
This concludes our podcast for today.